Good. So there were a few questions about, from several of you, kind of looking for a deeper understanding of measurement and when does a measurement happen, when does it not happen. And let me just say that I can answer those questions, but first we need to understand the theory of composite systems. So how do you describe multiple quantum systems that are interacting? What is the mathematical formalism for that? And then once we understand that, we'll do a little bit of theory of open quantum systems, which is the theory of real world systems, where typically the system of interest has interactions with other degrees of freedom, other systems that you don't have control over, and you can consider those to be noise or the environment, and you want to understand how your system will behave in light of those interactions that you're neglecting. So we need a good understanding of how to deal with multiple quantum systems for many body physics and condensed matter theory, for quantum information, entanglement and non-locality, theory of quantum measurement, decoherence, and much more. So this is very fundamental. And then the mathematical structures you're going to see today are actually implicit in what you learned in wave mechanics. So in wave mechanics, you were kind of doing this maybe without realizing it. Just as to kind of locate myself, how many of you are familiar with the tensor product structure of quantum mechanics? How many of you are not familiar? How many of you are only familiar because you saw it a few weeks ago as part of the... Okay. So for those of you who have seen it, was it through a research project or through your undergrad courses? Did anyone see it in undergrad? That's impressive. Not many undergrads cover it. Was it in a standard quantum mechanics course or a quantum information course? How did you see it? Standard quantum mechanics. Okay, good. Good. All right, well, for many of you, this will be review then, but I'm going to cover it for completeness and detail. So the idea is you have, we'll start by considering two systems. Consider two systems. System A and System B. We can use different language, so we can refer to these as, these are different or distinct degrees of freedom. So the word degree of freedom is maybe a little bit unclear for some of you. You can think of examples would be, for example, one electron in 2D. So then we have, it has an X position and it has a Y position. So this would be A and this would be B. Or we can have two electrons in 1D. Okay, so then A would be electron one, x coordinate. And then let me just say particles here so we don't have to struggle with distinguishability versus indistinguishability at this stage. And B would be particle one, particle two, x coordinate. So let me give these examples names. I'll call these, this will be example one, this will be example two. Example three would be the electron x coordinate and its spin degree of freedom. So A would be the electron coordinate in 1D, and B would be the electron spin. There's another degree of freedom. So each degree of freedom gets a Hilbert space assigned to it. That's what the postulates tell us. So when we're describing both degrees of freedom simultaneously, then how do we construct, if we know the Hilbert space for each degree of freedom, how do we construct the Hilbert space for the composite system? So given HA and HB, we construct HAB from what's called the tensor product of HA and HB. So if we let the set of Ketz AK be an orthonormal basis for HA, and we let BL be an orthonormal basis for HB. So it's a basis, so it spans the space. Then HB is spanned by the orthonormal basis AK tensor BL. So there's several equivalent notations for this. You can just call it AK BL. Is a common way to do it. And then we have the dimension of HAB is equal to the dimension of HA times the dimension of HB. So recall that if we have a wave vector psi, let me call it phi. Given a wave vector phi in HA, we can always write phi is equal to a sum over L phi L AL, where I guess I should call it K. It's just a dummy index, so I can call it whatever I want, where phi K are just complex numbers that are determined from the inner product AK phi. Just a word of warning, for some reason, so for me, this is kind of like the cursive phi and this is the non-cursive phi, and I tend to use them interchangeably, so if it looks different, that doesn't mean anything. That's just a bad habit of mine. And similarly, for any, after psi and phi, I always run out of Greek symbols for quantum states. There's psi, there's phi.
C.
C, but Yeah.
So nice.
You like C? All right, I'll use C. So then we have C, which is an element of HB. So then we can expand C. It's a sum over CL, BL, where CL is equal to. It's always surprising what's going to animate you guys. All right, so given. Okay, you guys need to calm down about C. Given that we have these two expansions, now we want to write down some state of the full Hilbert space. So then we have some state psi, which is an element of HAB. So that means that we can always write, we can always expand psi with respect to the tensor product orthonormal basis. So we can expand psi with respect to k comma l psi kl ak tensor bl. We should really think of this as kind of one object. And then psi kl is computed by taking the inner product of akbl against psi. And again, this should be considered one object. So there's a few things to pay attention to here, and this is just a complex number. So there's a few things we want to pay attention to here. First of all, notice that A belongs to Hilbert space HA and B belongs to Hilbert space HB. So we've adopted a convention that the objects to the left of the tensor product belong to Hilbert space HA, and those to the right belong to Hilbert space HB. Now when we create, this is a dual vector. This is a dual vector, or this is an element of the dual space. An element of the dual space equal to HAB adjoint, which is bijectively related to the original space by Rietz's theorem. So by saying it's an element of the dual space, we're saying it's a linear functional. So remember, that's this where the stuff becomes important. This object between the parentheses is a linear functional acting on the states of the joint Hilbert space. So that means its job as a linear functional is to take as input a vector of that Hilbert space and return a scalar, a complex scalar. So indeed, that's the case. So this is a scalar. We act on some vector with this functional, we get a scalar. And then by Rietz's theorem, these functionals are in one-to-one correspondence with the vectors of the Hilbert space. So we can just denote them by with the same notation as the vectors. Even though it's in the dual space, we still keep the convention that the leftmost object is HA. Okay, so for example, if you had the inner product of AK tensor BL with, and here I'll drop the parentheses because people don't use parentheses. So for example, acting on AK prime tensor BL prime, then what that's equal to is the linear functional on the left acts on the ket on the left, and the linear functional to the right of the tensor product acts on the vector to the right of the tensor product. So this is just AK prime. And now this is a multiplication. This is just regular multiplication from kindergarten. So that gives us delta KK prime, delta LL prime. So that's a little bit of bookkeeping. So let's look at another example of how this works. in terms of the dimension, if HA is equal to some m-dimensional Hilbert space and HB is equal to some n-dimensional Hilbert space, then HAB is equal to CM tensor CN, which is exactly equivalent to an M times N dimensional complex vector space. So notice, last lecture we looked at the tensor sum, which is different from this. This is the tensor product. So the tensor sum is when you're adding Hilbert space as an addition, so you're growing your Hilbert space. So if you had, so contrast this with HA plus HB is equal to CM plus CN, which is equal to CM plus N. So if this is some four-dimensional Hilbert space and this is five-dimensional, then we get a nine-dimensional Hilbert space through the tensor sum, which is like adding subspaces together. And when we have a tensor product, if this is four and this is five, then this is a 20-dimensional Hilbert space, because it's called a tensor product because you're multiplying the dimensions of the Hilbert spaces. Okay, so you would do this operation if I'm describing, say, some system, some atomic system where I have a bunch of orbitals, and say my system is confined to the energy ground state and the first excited state. And then all of a sudden I change my fields, and all of a sudden the electron can go up to the second excited state because of the way I've changed its confinement. Then that means now all of a sudden my Hilbert space goes from a two-dimensional Hilbert space, and then I add an extra Hilbert space, so I get a three-dimensional Hilbert space because I have a ground state, excited state, and two excited states. But if I have an electron confined in 1D, and then I change my arrangement so that the electron can now explore two dimensions, then I'm adding a new degree of freedom. I'm not adding more accessible Hilbert space to the original degree of freedom. I'm actually changing to a new degree of freedom, which is up here. And in that case, I'd be multiplying the Hilbert spaces together. So when we're going to describe quantum measurement, for example, you have the system of interest, you have your measurement apparatus, we want a fully consistent quantum treatment of that. So now the measurement apparatus is going to be elevated to a quantum system with its own Hilbert space, and then I have my system of interest. And so we'll need a tensor product structure to describe, to do the theory of quantum measurement. So just some terminology, given two systems, so given two, we'll call them, you can also call them subsystems, A and B, we call HA tensor HB a bipartite Hilbert space or system. Given n subsystems, so A1, A2, all the way up to AN, then we have HA1, tensor HA2, tensor HAN, which is a n-partite Hilbert space or system. And everything just generalizes. So an example for quantum information is you imagine that you have n qubits. So each qubit lives in C2. Each qubit has h equal to C2, a two-dimensional Hilbert space. So then the total system is equal to C2 where this is an n-fold tensor product, which we can just write as C 2 to the n. And more importantly, the dimension of H total is going to grow exponentially with the number of qubits. You frequently hear that it's the exponential growth of quantum Hilbert space for qubits that's associated with quantum speedup. That's absolutely false. This is a classical effect as well. When you're describing n bits, you obviously only need n bits to describe it. So it's growing linear. Your description of the bit is growing linearly. When you have probability distributions on n gyroscopes, where you don't know the position of the gyroscope but describe it by some probability density on the two-sphere, then the space of probability distributions describing n such gyroscopes grows exponentially in n. So classically, we have exponential growth of a state space, which is the space of knowledge states grows exponentially classically. So there's a direct analogy between that and classical mechanics.
Sorry, but it's a bit different, right?
Just 1 second. Please.
Because in quantum mechanics, like, there's a fundamental limit that, I mean, in classical mechanics, that growing only happens because we don't have enough precision, right? Practical mm-hmm. precision. Mm-hmm. In quantum mechanics, it's not practical precision.
It's fundamental.
It's fundamental.
I totally agree. I agree. But the fact that we need a space that grows exponentially, first of all, in a sense, it is fundamental that you always have some imprecision, because otherwise that would imply we have infinite knowledge, which we don't classically. But I still, that aside, I do accept your point that in classical mechanics, we only get this growth of exponential state space because we artificially impose some notion of precision. And in quantum mechanics, it's not artificial, it's implied by the structure of the theory. And so I think that's a totally valid point. But I would agree to that, but I would also say that that my claim still stands, which is that the fact that we have an exponentially growing space is associated with lack of complete knowledge. It's not associated with some enabling capability. So I think when we look to understanding the enabling capability of quantum computing, let's not look at this exponential growth of Hilbert space, which just is talking about the exponential growth of our lack of knowledge of the system when you string together n systems that you don't have full knowledge about. So I would put it that way. Okay, I'll just add this as a remark. Okay, so now we're just going to do a review of some very basic mathematical properties. So we take some operator A, which is a linear operator on HA, B, which is a linear operator on HB. Then we have A tensor B is a linear operator on HA tensor HB. So now we were looking at composing states. Now we're looking at composing operators. So these can be unitary operators. They can be self-adjoint operators. They can be positive operators, whatever. So then let's define some constants. And then we have the fact that alpha A tensor B acting on some state psi, we're going to carry on with the notation from previous. This is going to be equal to the scalar alpha. You can put anywhere you want, pretty much. You can move it through the tensor product because it's just a scalar. So let me just emphasize that point. This is equal to A tensor alpha B acting on psi. And in particular, we would have then A tensor B acting on psi is going to be equal to a sum over KL. What was the coefficient? Psi KL. A acting on AK tensor B acting on BL. So because A is in Hilbert space A, it just hits this guy. And B, which is an operator on the second degree of freedom. So think about this first degree of freedom as the electron's position and the second degree of freedom as the electron's spin. So B is some operator like SZ, some 2x2 matrix acting on spin. So it kind of ignores this first degree of freedom because it doesn't act on it. It acts on the spin degree of freedom. So it carries right through the tensor product and hits the vector associated with its degree of freedom. And then we have linearity. So this is linearity of the quantum state. And then we have linearity of the operators themselves, which is that if you have A1 tensor B1 plus A2 tensor B2 acting on, phi tensor C, then that's just going to be equal to A1 phi tensor B1 C plus A2 phi tensor B2 C. And the rest is pretty straightforward. If you take a dual vector, if you have alpha psi tensor phi, and you take the adjoint to create the dual vector, the linear functional that's in one-to-one correspondence with this ket, then the way you do that is you complex conjugate the scalar, and you keep the ordering where the leftmost is system A and the rightmost is system B. And then the vectors turn into dual vectors. And then just the notation I was getting at earlier, I'll just repeat it for completeness. The notation depends on how careful you're being. So the most proper notation is to write psi tensor phi, but then you can also write this as psi A phi B, Or you can drop the subscripts and just say, well, I'm keeping track of the order without even mentioning the tensor product symbol. Just like when you learn multiplication, you know, you start writing it as 3 times 5, and then eventually you just get to 3.5 and so on. And when you have A times B, you just start writing it as AB. Well, we do the same thing with the tensor product where it's understood from context that this is a ket associated with system A and this is a ket associated with system B. And so we just kind of mentally keep track of what these things mean without explicitly writing out the tensor product. And essentially, this is what's happening. When you saw kets like this describing the hydrogen atom, you were implicitly using a tensor product structure. Okay, so for example, NLM as an eigenstate of hydrogen would really be, okay, there's an implicit tensor product. It's never actually occurred to me what it would look like with the tensor product. I think, and this is a guess, I think it would be N tensor LM, because N refers to the, this is spherical coordinates, so that's gonna mess with me, but I think this is essentially the radial degree of freedom, and then this is the orbital degree of freedom. So now this, there would be no tensor product here because M is denoting which state you are in the manifold of dimension 2L plus 1. So you have a 2L plus 1 dimensional subspace from the angular momentum of the electron proton system, and there's no tensor product between L and M because they're labeling, L is telling you what irreducible representation you're in, and M is which state in that IREP you're in. And so you have 1 degree of freedom, 2 degrees of freedom. And then on top of that, you would also, now, so I'm gonna put a question mark here because it's a little bit murky because we have both orbital angular momentum and spin, which have been combined into a composite degree of freedom of total angular momentum. So there's something going on there more complex than I'm prepared to articulate clearly. But just to give you a sense of, this structure is suppressed when you learn about this stuff in undergrad. Okay, so that's it. Any questions about the tensor product? No? So now let's just quickly recap representations of the tensor product. Let me just call it composite systems. So here, the most important piece of this is, first of all, making sure you can handle the bookkeeping. But the point is, keep your conventions straight. So you establish some convention and you stick with it. Okay, so let's again use our standard notation. What do we have? Phi is in Hilbert space A and Xi is in Hilbert space B. So then you have, let's just say that HA is equal to CM as before, and HB is equal to CN, and then we'll have some phi in here and some xi in there. And then we have a representation of phi. If we write down phi with respect to some basis, what do we call this? This had the basis AK, and this had the basis BL. So phi is written as phi K AK. And then we can write a representation of this ket in the basis AK. And then we get the column vector phi 1, phi 2, phi M. Now my apologies, it's a little bit confusing. Sometimes it's better to designate the scalar coefficients via a different symbol than phi because it can be confusing. It's not clear if phi 1 refers to an instance of a vector in HA or if it refers to a coefficient, but I hope it's clear that it, because it doesn't have the ket notation around it, it's just a coefficient. So each phi k is just a complex number. And then for some state c, we would have the same expansion, and then we would get the representation in the bk basis as c1, c2, all the way up to xn, where xl is a complex number. And now, then we write down some state psi, which is, now let's let psi, now we'll change the meaning of psi. Psi will be some non-trivial linear combination. So let's make it so how do we represent that? Maybe this is too advanced. Let me skip that. Let me just do, it's not too advanced for you guys. It's too advanced for me. What am I going to do here? Yeah, I don't want to do this. This isn't what I'm trying to show. What I'm trying to show is how do you represent phi tensor xi. And then this is where you adopt a convention. So the convention I like, which is most common, is that the rightmost index, I don't know if people write this as an acronym, so I'll write it out, is that the rightmost index varies most rapidly. Okay, so that means the rightmost index is going to be the xi index. So we're going to have phi 1 xi 1, phi 1 xi 2, phi 1 xi. I did this wrong. No, I did it right. N. And then we get phi 2 xi 1, phi 2 xi n. And then we go all the way down to phi m xi n. Okay, so if you adopt this rightmost index varies most rapidly convention, you represent states this way, and operators, likewise, you would have, if I have some operator O, which is defined as A tensor B, and then I define Aij is equal to Ai A Aj, and BKL is equal to BK BL. So you know how to write down, this is row, column, row, column. So this would be, this would give an M by M matrix, and this gives an N by N matrix. Then O would be represented as an MN by MN matrix. And the way you do it is you embed the rightmost matrix inside, I'll just show what it looks like. You get A11 times B, A12 times B, A1M times B. So this is B. A M1 B A M2 B A M M B. And in particular, what this looks like then is A11 B11 A11 B12 A11 B13 and so on, A11 B21 A11 BN1 A11 B1N. Why didn't my coefficients aren't really matching up here? And this is wrong, this is NN. So in other words, and then I would do the next matrix, the next element. So the next one down is going to be A21, B11, and so on. And then if you keep the convention here, the rightmost index is varying most rapidly. Okay, so the rightmost index is going 1, 2, n, and then 2, and then the leftmost indices are varying more slowly. And that way, if you act on this vector with this this matrix, you get exactly the operation of the form, whatever we had, A tensor B acting on the in the right order. All right. Sorry if this is extremely boring for several of you, but now we get to something a little more interesting, entanglement. So as noted previously, any state psi in HA tensor HB admits a decomposition of the form KL psi KL Now we adopt a definition. If a state chi admits the expression chi equal to alpha tensor beta. Now alpha and beta denote states. They were scalars earlier. If you can find an expression of this form for any alpha in HA and for any, this is for every. How do you say for any? How do you write for any?
Backwards E?
No, that's not.
This is for any.
Oh, shit.
Maybe for every is okay.
No, it's
for different.
That's for
it. For, it's for some.
There's such for some.
Did you want to say there exists?
I guess I'm doing it backwards. I want to say, here's how I do it. I say, if there exists alpha and beta, let's do this properly. If there exists a state chi in HAB and there exists a state alpha in HA and there exists a state beta in HB such that chi is equal to alpha tensor beta, then chi is called unentangled or factorable. Okay, so we start by defining the class of unentangled states. And then it's pretty easy to see that there are going to exist many states which are not of this form. In fact, almost all of the states are not of this form. This is a set of measure zero. So almost all states require more than one term in the sum with non-zero coefficients. And all of those states are called entangled. So I guess then otherwise, chi is entangled. Thank you. So entanglement is interesting because it leads to a whole bunch of interesting phenomena like Bell's theorem. Entanglement in and of itself is not actually quantum. It needs other ingredients to be quantum. But that's an advanced point. How do you tell if a state is entangled? So if I give you a decomposition of this form, how do you know if the state's entangled or not? So let me illustrate the problem. This is off the top of my head, so I apologize if I get it wrong. Suppose we have two-level systems or two qubits. And suppose I tell you that we have the state 0, 0 plus 0, 1 plus 1, 0 plus 1, 1. Let's make it more interesting than that. Let's call it that's perfectly fine. Okay, so it looks like I have a decomposition with more than one term. Is this state entangled? Any takers?
No.
No? No? Anybody want to take the other view? Don't do that. It's not entangled. So why not? I mean, you know, obviously you guys are on top of this, but look, just the fact that I wrote it down for some choice of basis that it looks like there's more than one coefficient that's non-zero doesn't mean I can't find a basis where there is only one term. So in particular, this is equal to 0 tensor 0 plus 1 over square root of 2, where this is a SZ eigenstate, and this is an SX eigenstate. Okay, so if I use the Z basis for the first system and the X basis for the second system, then I just have one term, and then therefore it's unentangled. Well, this implies. So that was a simple example, which you could see it by inspection. But in more generally, for a bigger Hilbert space and more terms in the sum, it's really difficult to tell. It's, in fact, infeasible by inspection to know whether or not there exists some choice of basis where you get this simple form. Okay, so how can we test if there exists an alpha and a beta that demonstrate the state is untangled, that demonstrate lack of entanglement? So there are several ways to do it. It turns out, and this should pique your interest, once we generalize to density operators rather than pure states, this is an unsolved problem. There is actually no known test for Hilbert space of dimension greater than 2 by 3 to determine if a quantum state is entangled, unambiguously. For pure states, there always is such a test, but for mixed states, there's not. So we'll build up to that, and then you'll see kind of one of the first major open problems that you'll understand all of the mathematics behind, and you can start tackling. But for now, let's review what is known about this. So there are several. So for pure states, there are several ways to tell this. There are several solutions. So the one we'll look at today is called the the Schmidt decomposition. How many of you are familiar with the Schmidt decomposition? Just about a third, a half maybe? Was it, oh, all of you? It was done in the...
the tutorial we did.
In the tutorial you did it.
Yeah, but I'm not sure they found the solutions.
Do any of you want me to review the Schmidt decomposition?
Yes.
Yeah. Just a couple? Okay. So basically we have a theorem due to Schmidt, which is that for any chi in HA tensor HB, we can always write there exists this decomposition where AI and BI are orthonormal bases the lambda I are non-negative and satisfy a square summable to one. Did you do the proof in the tutorial? Or did you just present?
They tried to do the proof.
Oh, okay, well the proof then is in the notes and you can review it if you want to see it again. So the usefulness of the theorem is this, is that we have the Schmidt number is the number of non-zero lambda I. And if this number is greater than one, then the state is entangled. And you can constructively find the basis or the Schmidt coefficients. Okay, that's all I had to say about this. Is there a question? Yeah.
So why can't you do this for any state, for any Hilbert space?
Oh, that works for any Hilbert space. Let me write down, I think I should write it down. So this is a complete solution for pure states. So for pure states, we can always define lambda I and determine which are unique and determine entanglement. However, for mixed quantum states, which we haven't formally introduced yet, but I think most of you have seen. Have any of you not seen the density operator formalism? Mixed states, you did it in the tutorial, I imagine. Just introducing the fact that we can describe non-pure states via a non-negative operator of trace one, is that something familiar to you? Most of you, yeah. So, okay, so this is I'll formally introduce it next lecture, but for now, for mixed states, which means density operators rho that are not of the form, which are not a projector, but just an arbitrary non-negative operator. For Vermeer states, there is no solution. There is no general method. Wow, I haven't even defined what entanglement is for mixed states yet. So this is really just a forward reference. Okay, so first I have to define mixed states, then we'll define mixed state entanglement, and then we'll see that there's a partial solution but not a complete solution for testing entanglement of mixed states.
Why can't you just calculate the entanglement entropy and check if it's non-zero?
That's a great question, and I can explain it to you now, but I think it's better to explain it once I've... Okay, just for you, I'll explain it right now. Everyone else, ignore this. I don't want to confuse anyone that hasn't seen it yet. Look, take a mixed state rho A and a mixed state rho B, and now calculate the reduced entanglement. So then the entropy of rho A is equal to minus trace rho A log rho A. So let rho A equal identity over D. There's maximum entropy, but there's no entanglement. These systems were prepared. In other words, you can have noise on system A that's not from its entanglement with system B, that's just from the fact that you don't know anything about A. Right? If you don't know what direction the gyroscope was prepared in, you describe it by a uniform probability measure. And that will have very high entropy. So the point is, the entropy test only works if you're promised the state is pure, the overall global state is pure. If the global state is pure, then the only way you can have entropy, non-zero entropy in your system A state, is from its entanglement with the other system. Because you have perfect knowledge of the joint system, which is incomplete knowledge, but perfect quantum mechanical knowledge. So that's the reason. So that was a forward. We'll see this formally in a couple lectures. Any other questions about this? Yeah.
See the way the sum there is over I. Does that imply that like H A and H B have to have the same dimension?
No, but it does imply that the sum. That's a very good question. The sum will be limited by the lesser of the two dimensions. So the smaller of the two dimensions limits kind of how much entanglement can be between the two systems. Okay, so now we can launch into the infinite dimensional Hilbert space stuff. How many of you know about gotta be careful here. The Gelfand triplet. How many of you are familiar with the fact that the eigenstates of position and momentum are not elements of the separable Hilbert space of quantum mechanics? Okay. How many of you know about projector-valued measures? Very few. Okay, good. So this will be new to almost all of you. So the next section of the class is infinite dimensional Hilbert space. This is a, okay, for those of you who are going into condensed matter and quantum information, what I'm about to tell you will probably never come up in your research careers. Those of you working on string theory and quantum gravity and topics like that, or even just doing like density functional theory for, you know, nanowires, this is very relevant. And ironically, it's relevant to understanding what's going on in wave mechanics. Whoops, sorry about that. So, what's the problem? The most basic elements that we deal with in undergrad quantum mechanics, which is called wave mechanics, in its simplest form, the original formulation of quantum mechanics, is we have these the position and momentum operators. position, which I'll start calling, I call it X here, and momentum. P. And then we have, in wave mechanics, we introduce this notion that there's some set of eigenstates. So these are operators now. And then this is a scalar. So now X prime is a real number. And of course, X prime is a ket in some space. That's going to be the problem. What space? And then you can talk about this kind of heuristic formula. Okay, so these are kind of heuristic formulas. Or I guess formulae, if I want to be precise. A heuristic just means hand waving, basically. They're not rigorous in the structure we've discussed. So why is that? Well, consider, and then we usually assume that we have inner products. And then we also have so here, think about where here we're maybe it'd be better to write this as let me put the prime here. And let me swap P and X here. So we think about working in the X basis, which is the basis of wave functions in regular Euclidean space. And then we think about representing this momentum ket. This momentum ket we represent by a plane wave in wave mechanics. And then the position ket we represent by this Dirac measure. But notice that when we talked about the Hilbert space, the Hilbert space of wave mechanics, is L2R. Who remembers what L2R means? This is in one dimension, so R means one dimensional system. So there's only one degree of freedom, which is the position X, and it can take on any value in the real line. Who remembers what L2R refers to from earlier in class? A little bit of courage back there? No? Okay. So what it means is square integrable functions. So this is a class of functions, the wave functions. A class of functions, so psi is an element of H if it's square integrable. So that means we integrate over R dx psi x squared, and we demand that that be finite. Okay, we don't allow wave functions which go off to infinity and have a non-zero value. So why is that? What's the physical reason for making that requirement?
And normalize your probabilities.
Normalize probabilities, exactly. You can't have infinite probability. You've got to be able to normalize it, which means it has to be some constant. So as long as it's finite, we can just divide by that finite number, and we can normalize the state. So psi is an element of H if it's square integrable, where what does psi of X mean? Psi of X is defined as psi with respect to this position vector, which is an eigenstate, so to speak, of the position operator. But now we see that we can ask, well, are the position eigenvectors themselves square integrable? Can we imagine the particle has a definite position represented by this position ket? And you realize that, well, no, you can't write delta x minus x prime squared dx, I don't even know if that's a well-defined integral or if it's well-defined and infinite. So that's something I should know. But the claim here is that, I'll just say this, that statement is not true without knowing how to evaluate it, okay? And then similarly, this podium really gets in the way. I mean, you can't even see what's going on down here. Okay, so similarly, the position plane wave, let's just write it as e to the ipx. We try to check if it's square integrable. So we do e to the ipx norm squared, put a minus sign in there if we want. And then you try and evaluate that and you realize, well, this is actually one. So we actually have integral of dx times one, which is from minus infinity to infinity. Okay, so we're kind of toast here because now all of a sudden this is undefined. This is infinite. So these fundamental objects, these eigenstates of position and momentum, are not vectors in our Hilbert space. Okay, so this is a problem. And this is a problem that's been recognized for about 75 years. And so there are two main solutions to this. So there are two approaches to kind of cleaning things up and getting a consistent theory for quantum mechanics. I'll have to erase now. Why don't you guys let me know if you have any questions about what we have so far there. So that's the problem. Actually, there's another aspect of the problem. I'll skip that aspect of it. Okay, let me just remark. Similarly, remember we looked at three different examples of infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces, and I said they were all equivalent. So let's suppose we say, well, L2R is the problem. Let's assume that there's a finite universe. Okay, so let's assume that we don't need to know what A and B are, but we know that there are some limits to the universe. So we're happy to talk about this as our Hilbert space for wave mechanics, where A and B are so big that we in practice can't tell that they're not infinite. Okay, so this is the condition. Then the requirement, psi is in L2AB if, I'm going off script here, so I hope I don't screw up. So if the integral from A to B of psi of x squared is finite. Now, I don't know what will happen with the position eigenstate. I'll leave that as an exercise for you guys to tell me about tomorrow. But the momentum eigenstate looks more promising because now we're going to integrate to a constant. Okay, so now for the plane wave, we'll have, which is going to be equal to b minus a. So that's pretty good. But now here's the problem. It turns out that the momentum operator, which has these nice eigenfunctions that are in L2AB, the momentum operator is not self-adjoint on L2AB. Okay, so this kind of cheap solution to handle momentum plane waves doesn't work because we no longer have a self-adjoint operator, which that means we can't promise that the eigenvalues are real numbers, and so we have a problem with physical observables and so on. So the correct solution, so there are two solutions to overcome this difficulty. So solution one is due to Dirac, and it's called the rigged Hilbert space. Approach. So here, this sounds pretty nefarious. Rigged Hilbert space. So this doesn't mean rigged as in a casino you don't want to play at. It means rigged in the sense of a sailboat that's equipped for going out to sea. Okay, so it has its riggings. So that means you're equipping Hilbert space with structures that allow you to make use these formulas, which we want to use to solve problems in wave mechanics. We need a theoretical underpinning so that these are well defined. And Hilbert space as it exists, separable Hilbert space structure, is not adequate. And so what we do is we introduce what's called the rigged Hilbert space structure to accommodate the position and momentum operators, which are unbounded operators on the Hilbert space. The other solution is due to von Neumann. And here what von Neumann does is he preserves separable Hilbert spaces. But loosely speaking, discards the operators themselves. And he generalizes the operators. Projector valued measures. Okay, so you can use either approach, and neither is fine, really. Infinite dimensional Hilbert space is probably some kind of proxy for some physics we don't understand anyways, so I wouldn't stress about this too much. For those of you who really love math, the math behind this is definitely non-trivial. Let's get into it. Any questions so far?
So why do you assume the P and X in the product is the form, just based on the physical fact?
I mean, I think you're asking kind of a historical question. This becomes justified within the rigged Hilbert space picture. So it is rigorously defined. But the point is it was introduced historically prior to its justification as a convenient tool. I think also, I mean, you guys can correct me if you know the story, but this object here is called a Dirac measure because Dirac introduced it to describe the situation of interest, and which is a point particle, which is this idealization of having perfect knowledge of position of a particle. And the mathematical, this is actually a functional and not a function, and the mathematical theory required to justify this kind of object in the space of probability measures didn't even exist at the time. So he said, look, I want this kind of object. I want it to have properties which are on physical grounds. He demanded that I be able to have a function such that this was true. So he demanded that to be true. He didn't derive it to be true. And then later on, a theory of measures was developed, which included these distribution functions and other objects, which allowed this to be defined in a rigorous mathematical framework. So kind of Dirac had this incredible intuition that one should be able to have an object of this form, which was then later justified mathematically. So the point is, we just kind of use it as a practical tool in the calculations of wave mechanics, like tunnel problems and so on. You know, a beam tunneling through a barrier, you use a plane wave just to do the calculation. You can always approximate it as some really, really, really narrow Gaussian in momentum or a really narrow Gaussian in position, and then take the limit that the narrowness goes to zero later on as a proxy for this object. But did that answer your question?
Asking the first one.
This object?
Yes.
Oh, if you want to change basis. If you're working in the position basis and you want to start working in the momentum basis, you have to replace these objects with this plane wave. Or if you just want to represent a momentum eigenstate, sorry, my original question, my original answer applies to this. If you want to represent a momentum, a particle with well-defined momentum, which is a plane wave, in impinging on a barrier, you represent it via this plane wave. And what that means is you're representing the momentum eigenstate in the position basis, which is the wave standard wave mechanics picture. You're writing your state vectors. The standard wave mechanics picture is I write my quantum state in the position basis, and I get a function, a complex valued function. So we go, this is a, so this kind of object is an abstract mathematical relationship between two vectors. And this object is just a function that belongs to a space of functions. So this ends up being, wave mechanics is a representation of the Hilbert space framework, where that representation is a class of complex functions that are square integrable. So there's this subtlety that's kind of glossed over, this difference between the abstract elements, which are these abstract kets, and the wave functions, which are a representation of the ket in as wave functions. So I don't know if you saw this in undergrad, but you can also do representations of like the harmonic oscillator and so on via infinite dimensional matrices. So that's just another representation. That's representing the Hilbert space structure rather than an L2R. That's representing it in terms of L2, which are these, which I presented at the beginning of class, which are these, which is this space L2 is the space of column vectors, infinite dimensional column vectors that are square summable. So you can also do wave mechanics in this picture as well. So there's different ways of doing, representing the abstract structure as terms of concrete mathematical objects. And it's just like choosing a basis. The way you can do signal analysis by representing a time-dependent signal in terms of its Fourier modes. So I can decompose the signal in time as coefficients over my harmonics. So I'm using the harmonics as a representation of the signal. So it's one of these things that you kind of don't have to worry about it until you have to worry about it. That's why it's kind of suppressed in normal discussion, commonly. Actually, because the Dirac approach and the von Neumann's approach take us a block of time, maybe this is a good stopping point, and we'll follow up on this tomorrow during tomorrow's lecture. Thanks for all the great questions today. See you tomorrow.
And the eigenfunction.